How can a microchip manufacturer keep track of 250 million control points at once?
How can technology behind animated movies help enterprises reimagine their future?
Built for Change listeners know those answers and more. I'm Elise Hu.
And I'm Josh Klein. We're the hosts of Built for Change, a podcast from Accenture.
We talk to leaders of the world's biggest companies to hear how they've reinvented their business to create industry-shifting impact.
And how you can, too.
New episodes are coming soon, so check out Built for Change wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Michael Barbaro. Daily listeners often ask how they can support this show. The answer is through a subscription to The Times. It's the journalistic engine that powers The Daily. Times reporting is what makes The Daily The Daily. For those who already subscribe, thank you. For daily listeners who don't yet subscribe, The Times is now offering 50% off your first year, plus your first month free. It's a good deal. To learn more, visit nytimes.com/thedailyoffer. That's nytimes.com/thedailyoffer. And thank you. From the New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is The Daily. Today, nearly 400,000 Muslims have fled Myanmar in recent weeks. How could a small southeastern nation, celebrated by the U.S. as a good news story of democracy, now be condemned by the U.N. as a, quote, textbook example of ethnic cleansing? It's Thursday, September 14th.
I want to make a pledge to the people of this country that I am confident we can keep.
And that Hannah Beach, take me back to 2012. Why does President Obama visit this tiny country of Myanmar?
One of the most important goals of Obama's trip was to begin reestablishing diplomatic relations with Myanmar.
I'm proud to be the first American president to visit this spectacular country.
Myanmar used to be called Burma, and since 1962 was ruled by an army junta that, you know, I mean, army juntas in general are not
right.
Good things, but this was a particularly brutal junta. And so when Obama arrived, it was a situation in which a military regime was peacefully looking like it was transitioning and potentially giving power to an opposition.
Our goal is to sustain the momentum for democratization. That includes
building federal government. You know, he met with Aung San Suu Kyi, the opposition leader.
And I am very pleased that one of my first stops is to visit with an icon of democracy who's inspired so many people, not just in this country, but all around the world.
Aung San Suu Kyi is the longtime democracy and opposition leader in Myanmar, and she was under house arrest for the better part of 20 years at the behest of Myanmar's generals.
The moment that many thousands of Burmese people had been waiting for years. Aung San Suu Kyi clambered onto steps at the gate of her home. A free woman, she waved and smiled at the thousands who'd gathered to witness this historic moment.
She was this kind of icon of resistance. She's beautiful. She wears flowers in her hair. She became sort of a global human rights icon, and she won the Nobel Peace Prize.
I would like to say how happy I am to receive President Obama in my country and in my house.
She's the Nelson Mandela of Asia, except that she's got the flowers in her hair.
The United States has been staunch in its support of the democracy movement in Burma, and we are confident that this support will continue through the difficult years that lie ahead.
Obama actually visited twice, it's a tiny country, and you think here is a U.S. president who manages to visit twice within a short period of time. It's pretty remarkable.
Myanmar, Nangan Minglaba.
When Barack Obama gave his speech in Yangon, it was all sort of feel-good, happy stuff. But he did do one thing, which is he sort of injected a note of caution.
No process of reform will succeed without national reconciliation.
The majority of the people in Myanmar are Buddhist. Most people in the country, including Aung San Suu Kyi and members of the Myanmar military, are Buddhist. But there is also a complicated relationship that the majority Buddhists have towards some of the minority groups, particularly Muslims.
But there's no excuse for violence against innocent people.
He talked about the plight of the Rohingya, which is an ethnic minority, a Muslim, mostly stateless ethnic minority that lives in the far west of the country.
And the Rohingya hold within themselves the same dignity as you do and I do. National reconciliation will take time, but for the sake of our common humanity and for the sake of this country's future, it's necessary to stop incitement and to stop violence. And I welcome the government's commitment to address the issues of injustice and accountability and humanitarian access.
But toward the end of the Obama administration, a lot of bad stuff started happening in Western Rakhine State, which is where the Rohingya live.
There's been intermittent fighting between Muslim and Buddhist communities for years, even during Myanmar's military rule. Newfound freedoms to protest are now creating new challenges for Myanmar's reformist government.
There were military pogroms against villages. There were looting and burning of villages, extrajudicial killings, mass rape. The United Nations released a provisional report in which they said that this had some hints of ethnic cleansing, and large populations of Rohingya began to flee across the border to Bangladesh.
So, Hannah, that's a pretty alarming development. Catch us up to now. You recently returned from the border of Myanmar and Bangladesh. What did you see there?
In late August, a Rohingya militant group attacked a bunch of Burmese police posts and an army base, and they ended up killing upwards of a dozen Burmese security forces. The retribution that followed is almost unimaginable. And since August 25th, about 370,000 Rohingya have fled to Bangladesh.
370,000, that's a huge number.
That is, yeah, that's the number so far. And human rights groups say that there may be as many as 150,000 who are still trying to get across the border. So this is an exodus of biblical proportions. I saw them streaming across the border. And they were just coming day by day by day, this endless stream of people, mostly women, children, tons of children. The border between Bangladesh and Myanmar is divided by a river. Very few people knew how to swim, so there were some drownings.
See the body? Thrown from there, from Myanmar.
Some men coming across carrying sometimes absolutely nothing. I saw a little kid who was completely naked, who it was raining very badly because of the monsoons, and he had this giant sort of jungle leaf over his head, and that was sort of the entirety of his possessions was this one leaf. People had fled their villages, sometimes without being able to bring anything. And, you know, a lot of the kids didn't have much in the way of clothing. And, you know, everybody was barefoot. There were some people who were affected by landmines, which the Bangladeshi government has accused the Burmese government of having laid landmines. So, you know, you're a refugee trying to flee somewhere, and then you're almost over the border, and then you get hit by a landmine. When I was in a refugee camp, which was just overflowing with new arrivals from Myanmar, I met a guy named Mizanur Rahman, and he was cradling something. I couldn't really tell what it was, and I looked over and I realized he was holding this little baby, this very skeletal little baby. He described how on August 25th, he was in his rice paddy in northern Rakhine State. And suddenly he heard the sound of helicopters, of choppers roaring in the sky above him. And he said, you know, immediately I had fear in my heart. And so he said he called his wife. His wife came running out of the house with their baby, who at the time was less than a month old. And, you know, they knew that something bad was going to happen. And so they ran into the nearby jungle. And they watched as the helicopter shot something that produced fire in their village. Myanmar security forces came out of the helicopter, and he, you know, he couldn't see everything, but he started hearing the sounds of gunfire. As they were fleeing, he saw one of his brother's bodies lying on the ground next to other villagers. And it took them 3 days to get toward the border with Bangladesh. And when they got to the border, they ran into a group of Myanmar border guards. And Mizanur Rahman said that his mother was then shot dead by a Myanmar border guard. And, you know, when I saw him, he was wandering through this market in a refugee camp, but he had no money. You know, he had this little baby who was not getting enough nourishment. And the baby had the kind of the parched skin, the dehydrated skin at its joints. And there was a sort of heartbreaking moment where, you know, you're surrounded by people who have lost so much. And every single person there had sort of a horrible story. And yet the kind of plight of this young father standing there cradling this baby. And even these other refugees who had gone through so much would sort of take turns, and they would very, very gently kind of touch the baby's feet to see if the baby was still alive.
Why is Myanmar's government, as you're describing it and as he is describing it, burning the villages of these Muslim minority people in the western part of the country?
I mean, the Myanmar government says that it is conducting clearance operations and trying to root out what they define as terrorists. One of the many tragedies of this is that, yes, there was a militant attack on these police posts and innocent Myanmar security forces were killed. The problem is that the militants did not return to their villages after they committed this attack. And so when the Myanmar forces ended up going into the villages and burning down houses, raping women, the people who were there, a lot of them were simply innocent civilians. The militants weren't there.
I want to zoom out for a minute because we're talking about Muslims in a minority who the majority have clearly marginalized. And it sounds like an element of this Rohingya minority is waging what it sees as a fight for its rights and its freedom. Is it now inherently easier for a country like Myanmar to label a group of people that it doesn't want in its country anymore, if they happen to be Muslim, as terrorists?
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the ironies of the Myanmar government labeling the Rohingya militants as terrorists is that if you take another ethnic militant group, the Rakhine ethnic army called the Arakan Army, and last year, within a six-month period, the Arakan Army actually killed around 300 Myanmar soldiers. But the Rakhine are Buddhist, and nobody is calling the Arakan army a terrorist force. So I think it's very easy for the Myanmar government to call the Rohingya militants terrorists because it fits into this kind of convenient global narrative about transnational terror networks that happen to be connected to Islam. I mean, the sad truth is that there is no more fertile ground for militant groups to find disenfranchised, unhappy young men than a refugee camp or than kind of a ghetto in Rakhine. And I think the real worry is of radicalization. And so the Myanmar government may not have had a terrorism problem, but it is conceivable that that could happen. And that's a tragedy because this is a problem that could have been prevented.
So I have to return to Aung San Suu Kyi, this Nobel Peace Prize winning leader of Myanmar, who seemed like the great hope for bringing the country out from the cold and back into the global community. What are people saying about her and her role in this extraordinary crackdown?
Yeah, I think for the international community, even though people recognize that her civilian government is limited, you know, they have some power, but they don't control the military. They don't control the border guards who are doing some of these horrible things. There is a certain amount of powerlessness that Aung San Suu Kyi faces. At the same time, she won a Nobel Peace Prize because of her association with democracy and human rights.
Her reputation is tarnished, and her country is beset by problems.
And the one thing she does have is a voice, and she has the moral authority to be able to say, you know, we condemn this kind of violence.
And has she done that?
No, she has steadfastly refused to say that.
Myanmar has rejected accusations that its military is conducting a campaign of indiscriminate violence targeting Rohingya Muslims. The country's de facto leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, said the crisis in Rakhine State was being distorted by what she called misinformation.
Now, one of the reasons that people give for her silence on this is that the level of anti-Muslim and particularly anti-Rohingya sentiment in Myanmar is so large that were she to say something in defense of them, that would hurt her politically. But when you get to the point where you have more than a dozen Nobel laureates who are writing you open letters.
Malala Yousafzai, a fellow recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize, this week called on Aung San Suu Kyi to condemn what she called the tragic and shameful treatment of the Rohingyas.
Who's saying, you know, dear sister, do something. When you have Archbishop Desmond Tutu.
The Archbishop called on the leader to speak out against the unfolding horror that some have described as ethnic cleansing.
Saying, if the price of your ascension to power is your silence on this, then it's too much for us to bear. And these are deep condemnations from people within the human rights community.
Several calls have been made for Suu Kyi to be stripped of her 1991 Nobel Peace Prize, forcing the committee's chair to say, we do not have the mandate, nor is it our task to evaluate what Nobel laureates do after they've won the prize.
So finally, Hannah, I wonder if the Obama administration, which is where we started this conversation, by welcoming Myanmar back into the global community, by doing it so enthusiastically, by betting so big on Aung San Suu Kyi, did it make a mistake? Did it act too soon, given what you're describing her government as doing?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think that there was perhaps a slight bit of naivete about exactly what this government is. You know, it is not a real democracy at the moment. It is still this kind of quasi-military, quasi-civilian government that doesn't fit into any neat box. And I think we wanted a simple narrative of, yay, this country has become democratic, you know, and that's wonderful. And it's much more complicated than that. And so I think in terms of Aung San Suu Kyi herself, there are people who in hindsight say, yes, we were worried that she might take this path. But I think a lot of people also have been surprised at the extents to which she has gone to try to not address this issue.
Hannah, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Last year, I warned that the pattern of gross violations of the human rights of the Rohingya suggested a widespread or systematic attack against the community, possibly amounting to crimes against humanity.
On Wednesday, Aung San Suu Kyi canceled a planned visit to the United Nations General Assembly next week in response to the storm of global criticism over the situation in Myanmar.
The current situation cannot yet be fully assessed, but the situation remains, or seems, a textbook example of ethnic cleansing.
We'll be right back.
I'm Shane Goldmacher. I'm a national political correspondent for the New York Times, covering the 2024 election. I have off and on for years covered the role of money in politics, and that means sifting through tens of thousands of line items in campaign reports, looking at who's getting paid, how much they're getting paid, who's donating to these campaigns, who's reserved the most ads on Google, who's this billionaire changing the shape of the race with a single check, Look, the campaign spin, the strategists tell you one thing, the numbers don't really lie, and those numbers help us ask the right questions. That's what's so special about the New York Times. We get to tap the collective knowledge and wisdom of my colleagues who have expertise in every nook and cranny of this country and this campaign trail to tell you the full story of what's happening in these critical moments in the last few weeks of the election. If this kind of coverage is important to you, you can support it by subscribing to the New York Times at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Here's what else you need to know today. On Wednesday night, the two top Democrats in Washington, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer and House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi, announced that they had reached a deal with President Trump to protect young undocumented immigrants from deportation. After a White House dinner with the president, Schumer and Pelosi released a statement that appeared aimed at ensuring he would follow through after their discussions on DACA. Quote, "We agreed to enshrine the protections of DACA into law quickly," they said, "and to work out a package of border security, excluding the wall, that's acceptable to both sides." In its own statement, the White House was more reserved, mentioning DACA as just one of several things that were discussed over dinner. And
there was no air conditioning then. And our friend Betty on the second floor, she was out in the hall and she couldn't hardly breathe. And it was hot. They had her sitting in front of a fan.
On Wednesday, hospital staff at Memorial Regional Hospital in Hollywood, Florida, grew concerned after receiving a third rescue call from a nursing home down the street. They discovered a facility that had become an oven, with dozens of patients sweltering after Hurricane Irma knocked out their air conditioning system, and temperatures rose past 90 degrees. At least 8 people have died, and almost 40 more were in critical condition.
This is an emerging scandal of great proportions.
Florida officials are calling for a criminal investigation into why the nursing home's owner failed to evacuate residents, as required under federal regulations. That's it for The Daily. I'm Michael Barbaro. See you tomorrow.